Or maybe it's you. You're just a positively charged individual.
I do have bare feet currently.
Oh, that's the Queensland way.
It is, because it's going to be 31 degrees here today. Yeah. And given that there's storms around, humid isn't.
Welcome to GCP Bites, episode number 4 for Friday, the 25th of October, 2024. GCP Bites is a podcast where we discuss Google Cloud and tech. I'm your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, there's a new GCP VP for Australia and New Zealand. How will Google power its future? What's our old mate Mellon Husk up to? Plus, can NVIDIA keep up with the demand in the AI wars? But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce the co-host of the show, Dave Wall. How are you, Dave?
I am absolutely awesome, mate. Ready awesome. To get going.
And our very own GDE, Ian Brown. How are you, Ian?
I'm good, thank you. How are you guys doing?
Good, 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 good. Oh, look, 17 minutes we've been gas bagging for. We're supposed to start at 7:30 on the dot, but it's now 7:47. We've got to sharpen up our act, guys.
No, I got 17 minutes of just cold open just, to dump into.
Just Dave and I talking garbage. Yeah.
Which, in fairness, we've done in a professional context. So.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, for 30-odd years, yeah.
That's right. What have you guys been up to during the fortnight?
Much? I got myself a new Pixel.
Very nice. Yeah,
which is awesome. And my son's got my Pixel 7 now.
Okay,
and now he's bummed out.
The regular.
No, just the regular one.
Oh yeah,
the Pixel 9 is expensive enough without having to go the Pro one. $1,350 for a phone.
That's crazy.
Never thought it'd get to that stage. But anyway, I'm loving the. No, I can't remember what they call it. It's like Gemini Live. That's on the phone.
Okay, cool. Tell us about it.
You can just talk to Gemini, cool. Like have a full-blown conversation with Gemini on the phone, and it's interacting with you normally. So
on the, what do you say? Do you just say, like, go live or something, and it's just a buddy to chat to? Or
no, it's just so the Gemini model has essentially replaced the Google Assistant. Mm-hmm. I can't say it too loud. My phone's on the bench here. And even though it's turned upside down, it loves responding for that word. And so you just start out your conversation the same way as you normally would and start having a conversation with Gemini.
So this is my Pixel 8 Pro. Is it the same thing?
Yep, exactly the same thing, except right. I've got on mine, if I jump into it, yeah, so I've got the same thing, just little button down the bottom there, and you can start live chatting with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it works a treat.
Yeah, okay. And the 7, they didn't bring that into the 7?
No. So when Matt, my young fellow, was showing me, he's actually missing the little button on the very right-hand side of the text box.
With the squiggly line and the plus on it.
Yeah, I've got a 7 Pro here, so I'm going to have a look at the same.
Maybe you need the TPU to do that.
I think that's the case, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What have you used it for? Are you using it for, to help you with a task or just, you know, chat about the weather? Or?
At this point, it's... seeing what sort of really inappropriate things you can say to Gemini and see what it comes back with. The same way we tested Siri when that first came out on an iPhone.
That's right. Yeah. Hey, be good to get two phones in the room next to each other and see if you can get it to have a conversation with itself.
That just sounds like the fun. Fourth guest on the podcast.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Well, cool. All right. And what else have you? Is there anything else that grabs you about it?
Look, it's a phone. The camera's fantastic on it. I love the camera. Apart from that, like, it makes phone calls and sends text messages, and I can see my email on it. That's really all I use it for.
It makes phone calls.
I know. I know it's a random concept.
And the electric telephone.
Yeah. Give me one of those old rotary dial things, and I'll be right.
Yeah, you could get by with a party line.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I could too because I know how to run them.
Oh, maybe well, I don't know about you guys, but did you catch the Starship booster test catch?
I see what you did there.
That was yeah. so good.
That was cool.
It, that just absolutely blew me away. I got a buddy of mine. We used to work together, but we usually text each other if there's like, especially like a test launch of something interesting happening. And so we both stayed up late on the like the Sunday night. It was like 11:25 when it launched our time. Sitting there watching it, like, oh god, it's gonna crash. It's gonna do it. It's gonna hit that tower. It's going. Oh my goodness!
Guys, catch.
Mm. Yep. Yeah. Got him.
Yeah, just absolutely amazing. And then, I mean, for the Australian connection there, you see that when Starship came down, the actual, like, the second stage came down, that was off the northwest coast of Australia. And the Australian Space Agency had a part in helping out with that. So there was a couple of buoys out in the bay, out in the water there, and they had cameras. And Starship came down like within view of the buoys. And yeah, so pretty cool. Kind of hoping actually. That maybe on future flights, they because they are going to have to test landing it, there's a very real chance that it might be able to land like in the top end of Australia.
Right.
That would be where they would do it rather than doing a full orbit around and try and come down in the US in a more habitated area. Yeah, given our relationship with the US and various ITER considerations. I think there's actually a pretty good chance that we might actually have it land here, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. It's pretty remote out there, so the chance of actually hitting anything is unlikely.
Just don't crash in a pine gap.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible they actually did that. The forces at play with that much weight coming down and the amount of thrust involved and to do that so accurately is incredible. I saw a bit of footage where there was a camera mounted underneath looking at the thrusters and you kind of think that all the thrusters are moving in unison, but no, every thruster moves individually.
Their own gimballing.
Their own gimballing, yeah. Just like mind blown to actually work that out.
You got to think about the amount of electronics that's involved to actually tell that this thing is tilting ever so slightly in one direction and correct it before it gets out of hand.
Yeah, because
it does get out of hand really quickly.
The thing is, it's doing that in advance. Because it's like, I'm going to start shifting this way and then that's going to shift the whole yaw of the entire rocket. So in advance, I need to start gimballing back the other way. Really amazing. I thought it was really cool with the launch because the actual flight profile for the booster return was set to be in the bay, right? So to be like I think it's the Gulf of Mexico.
Yep.
Right. So that's where it was programmed to come down. And it was a manual step from like launch control to sort of monitor it and go, okay, yep, everything's looking nominal. Now send the approval to switch to the tower catch model.
Oh, okay. So they didn't plan for it at all. It was just
So it was good, planned. So. They had both profiles there, but they programmed it to land in the bay. So if it's like if it lost signal control or if anything was going on, because it's not just a test of what the booster could do, it was a test of the catching mechanism, the chopsticks on the tower,
right?
Making sure that they were actuating correctly, they'd be able to respond. So once everything was confirmed as going, then they manually set the go-ahead to switch to the landing profile.
Yeah, so they had to plan for fail safe.
Correct.
That's what that was. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So really awesome.
Mm.
But yeah, I thought that was pretty exciting. And I think, like, as a very different note, but just on my own little tech adventures and a little rant, I've upgraded one of my machines to the latest Windows 11 release. It just came out.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, it just came out this week. They've pulled the release for like a bunch of devices because, as happens, you know, bugs everywhere. But so this is the 2024 H2 release. And it's, you know, it's a feature update for Windows 11. A few little nice things that are in there. One sad note is that everybody's favorite app that you probably accidentally opened three times in your career, WordPad, has been decommissioned.
No!
It's like, I never want WordPad.
Can bet there's some site in the corner of the internet, you know, wordpad.exe, where you can still go and download it.
Oh, yeah, there will be.
That'll be there for the, there'll like, be, looks like a page from the 90s.
On the web soon enough.
Yeah, for sure. It's going to have an uptick in usage now that it's gone.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, WordPad's gone, but now you can sudo in the command line.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you're not opening administrator CMD.
Yeah, you can- correct. And that's, I know, like, Ian, when I pinged it into the chat saying, like, hey, you can sudo on Windows now, you weren't super excited about it. But for me, that's always been like a real bugbear. Like, I've opened a terminal and I'm typing away and I'm doing things. All of a sudden, I don't have permissions. Oh, I have to reopen it with admin.
Go to the directory I was in, yeah.
So, yeah, so yes, okay. I'm not super excited about it because I see it as Microsoft trying to replace Linux by becoming Linux.
Yeah.
But on the flip side of that, I remember the having to use the run as command to run things as the administrator on the box, and that was just, like, that whole command just to do that is painful enough as in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got the issue of, okay, I'm not in the right directory to be able to run this command as that user, or I don't know what the password is for that user. And
yeah, so
whereas sudo is such a clean solution.
Yeah, and it gives you a few different options for the way sudo will kick off. So the default is that it opens another window. So it's similar to, you know, reopen as administrator, but you can do it in line as well. But you can also, you can do the sudo within the same window, but without allowing any user input. So I guess you can, like, have a sudo in a script without having then someone in user land using those privileges to do further mischievous activity.
How's the sudoers file handled?
That I don't know. I haven't sort of played around with that yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I guess it just uses Windows groups to put you in the group to use it, but then you obviously there's a bunch of stuff you can do in the sudoers file.
Yeah, true. That's right.
True. Yeah, I haven't checked yet to see how that works. I mean, for me, I've liked seeing more and more of the, you know, Linux utilities and way of doing things coming into Windows. It's like... like little things, like how, you know, SSH has been incorporated now for ages. Like, I don't miss having to have PuTTY on machines.
Yeah. PuTTY was such a garbage bit of software.
Yeah, but we all had it.
We had to use it because it was the only thing there. But it was such a garbage way of SSH.
They used to QSCIT for many years. That's pretty good.
Oh, yeah. But then, so I sort of look at this and go, okay, SSH was implemented. And from what I understood of it, and I haven't used the Windows box for quite some time, so correct me if I'm wrong, the implementation wasn't identical to what it is on a Linux box or a Unix box. The same with they had another tool in there that they implemented that had entirely different switches to it. I can't remember what it was now. I'll have to look it up.
Sure. Right. Yeah, I mean, I at least I know from my own utilization, it felt pretty similar. Like, so there might be more, you know, kind of niche use cases, but as a very basic level for me, then it worked fine.
Yeah, when you get into some of the more esoteric switches and things, then it might get a bit different. But at a basic level, it's probably the same.
Yeah, maybe you can't do things like proxying or something through it. I'm not too sure.
Or piping commands. No, because a pipe works for the most part. I can't remember what the command was now.
But yeah, that's everything kind of in my land. What about you, Banky? Yeah. What's been going on with you, mate?
Well, I got my replacement chips for my Commodore 64 for that U21. I haven't switched them in yet, but I don't have any time over the weekend, but I might get a little bit of time this weekend and hopefully get that up and running. Oh, and I wanted to complete the whole ensemble. I wanted one of those old school computer desks, you know, the really tall ones where you'd put the printer on the top.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, those things.
You'd have a little hutch that had like the CD tray storage.
Trays and stuff. Well, I got one. I managed to get one.
Oh, that's gold.
And it's brown. It's the 80s brown as well. Yeah. Yeah. So, look, the era is probably early 2000s, so it's a bit late for that kind of table. Yeah. But it's the colour is perfect, I have to say. It's a little bit worse for wear. I've got to change the casters and clean it up a bit, but it's just going to complete the picture. It's going to be awesome.
Nice. Are you going to get a little printer to stick on top, though?
Oh, a tractor feed one.
You've got to have a dot matrix printer.
Yep.
Track the feed. But I had one years ago for the Commodore 64, but yeah, it didn't work and it ended up going in the bin. We'll see.
You get one of them and then you can have the triplicate paper fed into it so you can print everything in triplicate. Yeah, that's bringing back memories, isn't it?
Yep. Oh, dear. All right. So, if any of you are bitten by, just before we get on with the community news coming up, if any of you are bitten by the Chrome disabling uBlock Origin, it looks like they're rolling out new versions of Chrome with Manifest 3, getting reports of it coming out now, but it hasn't affected me yet.
So, I don't use uBlock Origin. I use AdBlocker. Sorry, what was the name of the one that I'm using? AdGuard, that's it.
Right. Well, it'll probably be affected as well if it's using Manifest 2.
Yeah, so what I'm seeing is in Chrome, I'll get probably maybe four times a day a little pop-up down the bottom right-hand corner of the window that says that there's too many rules. The rule limit has been exceeded and I need to go and clean up the user rules. So, and I sort of had a look at this. This happened to me on Tuesday, actually. Mm. And I, because I did the updates after we'd done our pre-production meeting. And I went into AdGuard. I don't have any user rules in there. I'm like, that's not right. I don't have user rules. I can't, like, how can I be exceeding a limit when I've got none?
Maybe
so
you need
I'm
one.
Assuming that this is how they're doing
zeros.
It. Yeah.
Right.
So that's what I assume is happening there.
Okay. So is it still blocking ads?
Well, I can't really be sure because I also run Pi-hole on my network.
Yeah, that's
because
the...
I'm over ads. They're just so intrusive.
Oh yeah. Well, if you do use uBlock Origin, I mean, I've got Untangler, which blocks ads similar to Pi-hole, and I've got uBlock Origin as well. Which is good because that'll remove the ads from YouTube videos.
Not the server-side ads?
No. Only the client-side ones.
Yeah.
Only the client-side ones,
That's the new thing coming through with actually do the ad injection into the video.
Yeah.
You will watch ads.
Yeah, no, I will pay for YouTube Premium.
Yeah. I do currently because I use YouTube Music as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So there will be an alternative, which is uBlock Origin Lite, and it's a Manifest 3 version of the same plugin. It won't upgrade automatically, but when you start seeing ads, you'll have to uninstall the old version of uBlock Origin and then go put uBlock Origin Lite in. Apparently, it doesn't work as well, but it does block some ads.
So, okay.
Yeah. Your experience may vary. One last thing. Who put this in here SolarWinds? Yeah.
Yeah. So did we all see that the SEC over in the US has fined Unisys, Checkpoint, Mimecast and Avaya over the SolarWinds Orion breach? So I remember a couple of years ago when SolarWinds
got real badly done.
Got really badly owned. Yeah. So the SEC has come out and they've said that they're putting penalties against these four companies over what the SEC said were materially misleading disclosures after the series of breaches in 2020 and 2021.
So are they, okay, are they saying that these companies, so Checkpoint, so I guess firewalls and other stuff, Mimecast being, you know, email filtering and don't know what they're using Avaya for.
Avaya is a phone software company from last time I checked, but.
Yeah, like PABXs, right?
Yeah.
So they're blaming them for SolarWinds getting breached?
No. When I saw the article, I was like, hey, you can't blame like these companies passing, for the SolarWinds. Yeah. Anyway, no, it's not that. It's what they're saying is that when these companies disclosed the impact on that company, on their company, mm-hmm. from that SolarWinds exploit, that they played it down to nothing. They're like, oh, no, right, it's fine. Okay. Nothing's been breached. It's fine. And that's completely incorrect.
And sure enough, yeah. And
sure enough, I mean, we've discussed it a million times. Yeah. Makey is like, oh, this company's been breached by this. They're saying that nothing's gone. And then a couple of weeks later, oh, yeah, look, we lost all of our customer data. Maybe, possibly, it might be on the internet over here. For sale?
You're best just saying nothing at that point, right, until you have all the information. Yeah.
So what they're saying here is, according to the SEC's orders, Unisys, Avaya, and Checkpoint learned in 2020 and Mimecast learned in 2021 that the threat actor likely behind the SolarWinds Orion hack had accessed their systems without authorization, but each negligently minimized its cybersecurity incident in its public disclosures. So they're setting a precedent here by going after companies that are playing down the impact of these disclosures. Mm. And I can't wait until that starts happening in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we've seen that a heap of times. Yep. I mean, Medibank was a prime example of that.
When we had that spate of breaches a couple of years ago, that was the first thing you hear. Don't worry, nothing to see here, all good.
Yeah.
And lo and then, behold, yeah.
Yeah, and then might have lost some data, maybe.
That was just an interesting one. Yeah, it is an interesting one. All right, look, enough of the banter for now. Let's get on with the community news. GDG Auckland, what's this all about, Ian?
GDG Auckland is holding their DevFest event on the 10th of November. So if you're in Auckland, get yourself a ticket to go along. It's at Auckland University in the Sir Owen G. Glenn building. I'll be speaking there along with a whole heap of other GDEs and tech specialists at the event. And it's likely to be a great day.
Excellent. So if you're in New Zealand, do you have to book for that, or is it kind of a show-up-y thing?
Yeah, so you've got to book for it. The link will be in the show notes as is normal.
Yep. Go and check that out. Excellent. And with that out of the way, let's get on with the news items. First news item for this week is Google Cloud appoints Paul Migliori as ANZ Vice President. Google Cloud has, this is an article from IT Brief, Google Cloud has announced the appointment of Paul Migliori as the new VP for Australia and New Zealand, who'll be based in Sydney, and he'll lead the regional go-to-market strategy while coordinating with customers and partners to utilise AI through Google Cloud's technology.
Look at that. More AI.
More AI. The more AI is the better. he's been welcomed to Google Cloud. A quote from Karan Bajwa. I'm delighted to welcome Paul to Google Cloud. With his deep knowledge of the local market and proven track record in successfully growing cloud businesses, I'm confident Paul will help us advance our mission and unlock our next phase. He has a bit of a pedigree. He was the CEO of Versant. And that was acquired by Telstra. And prior to that, he was the managing director of AWS in Australia. And he had leadership roles at BT, IWG, and Ernst & Young.
Yeah, right.
Yes. So welcome aboard, Paul. I'll be tagging him in our post so he'll know exactly who we are.
I wish him all the best, and let's see if he can get Google to outpace Microsoft and AWS.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. I mean, in the last 12 months, we've made up big strides, but there's still a lot more that can be done, right?
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Moving on from the I told you so shelf, basket, Google strikes a deal with Nucleus startup to power its AI data centers. See, I told you.
Yep. Yeah, Google, it's got to happen, though.
It's got to happen. Google is turning to nuclear energy to help power its AI drive. On Monday, the company said it will partner with startup Kairos to power to build 7 small nuclear reactors in the U.S. They're building nuclear reactors to power their DCs. What a surprise.
Well, specifically for their AI. That's it. That's what they need it for, is because the amount of power required to drive the AI that they're currently building is just mind-blowing.
Absolutely. I mean, you could – yeah. Here's the thing. Like, in the Northern Hemisphere you have a need to heat things as well.
Mm.
So wouldn't it be good if they could use all that excess heat to somehow, I don't know, heat a city? Because I mean, you're right, the amount of power is stupid.
The heat is generating the power. Oh, do you mean from the data centers?
From data centers, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So given that nuclear reactors are just really just steam generators, just make water be hot, and that's
like, yeah,
that's yeah, yeah, they do are.
Right. It will turn data centers into make water be hot.
Hot.
we've just found a different, more ingenious way of making steam.
Yeah. It's actually kind of funny that, like, with the exception of, like, say, photovoltaics and you know, like, wind power, but so much of our power generation is water needs to be hot. That's
yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, like, pretty much everything
not,
in Australia.
We've not got any further. We've not got any further than that. We just heat up water.
Yep. Throw it across a turbine and off she goes.
Yeah.
Reminds me of the Large Hadron Collider, right? So that uses so much power that they have to shut it down in the winter because they need to heat Geneva.
Yeah.
That's how much power.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Take your choice. Run the LHC or heat a large city.
Okay. Well, maybe the LHC facility needs to get on board and build their own nuclear power station.
They might have to, yeah.
I even on this podcast, like, I don't know, what, 2 episodes or back, you know, we were sort of talking about SMRs, and I was, you know, I'm skeptical, right? Like, this is I'm pro nuclear power, but I need to see people actually be able to build them in timely fashion. So I am interested to see with this one, like, the first reactor is due to be live by 2030 and the remainder of the 7 by 2035. So if they can do it, if they can actually pull that off and they can have a model that they can roll out rapidly, then that is exciting. But I'm still going to sit with my little skeptic bucket, but I'm sure that, like, Google's done their due diligence on it, so.
Yeah, they wouldn't be signing a massive deal like that if they weren't fairly sure that it was going to go through.
Yeah,
But, yeah, because it's the deal is looking to add 500 megawatts of power, which out of SMRs, their small modular reactors, which is, and that's just by the decade's end. So that's just by 2030. So by the time they get the remainder of the reactors online by 2035, that's a considerable boost in power.
Mm. Yep. So I'm curious about the knock-on effects of this. So the way I see it, there'll be 2 potential knock-on effects. So suddenly, well, I say suddenly, not suddenly, but over time, I would imagine that Google will transition all their data centers, and this will be the trend, maybe all the hyperscales will transition all their data centers to local SMRs. And that is consumed power that is now no longer going to be consumed by the current grid.
Yep.
So in some cases, there'll be the potential for excess power in the grid. In some other cases, it may not, because, you know, the rest of the power consumption will ramp up in that time.
Yeah, now, I think as a society, we find ways to consume power, right? Like,
yeah.
Our consumption only goes up.
Actually, I've mentioned this in the show once before. If you look globally over like the last sort of 20, 30 years at power consumption, it's kind of remained steady. And that's because, yes, we do have more devices that use more power, but we've got better. They're more efficient. Mm. There's more devices, but they each use less power, so they got more efficient. Suddenly, in the last sort of 5, even 10 years, there's been a sudden uptick because of DCs and hyperscalers, and EVs are starting to make an impact as well. So, if they've removed themselves from the grid and they're using SMRs, that's kind of one effect. The other effect is, how are SMRs going to affect the traditional power infrastructure? So suddenly you could have like a local community or a local council go, well, we're going to put an SMR locally and power that community from an SMR rather than pull from the existing grid, like the coal-fired grid.
So I think where I see it come into is supporting the ongoing decentralization of power grids. Mm-hmm. So you've got the US, but like within Australia as well, as we're decommissioning a lot of our legacy coal, yes, there is incentives to like, okay, what can we use, you know, where the existing plants are because all the transmission lines and everything go there. But over time, as the power distribution nationwide is being updated, it's allowing us to say, okay, we've got generation all over the place. We've got solar, we've got gas, we've got all sorts of fuel sources. They don't have to be in the same locations, which means if, for example, you've got a bushfire that's going to impact an area or just like a generator outage, right, you're not going to have this situation where, oh, okay, Hazelwood's down and so all of Victoria has to go cold for a little while.
Mm-hmm. Like,
that's an interesting thought too, because I like, we have a look at it from Queensland's perspective, and there's probably 3 major facilities in Queensland that generate power for the state.
You got a major one that's out at the moment, don't you?
Yeah, well, there's always one that's down. it's just part and parcel of gas-fired power plants. Mm. But yeah, that very much the same case is all of those power plants are in areas where it will either be stupidly hot and there'll be a fire, or they're on the plains windy where it gets wet.
Mm.
So you have the floods that come through Queensland the last few years that have happened. And they cover sort of 60% of the inland of Queensland. So these power plants are getting flooded out because they're not up high.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, decentralizing and putting it in like smaller places, smaller facilities in lots of different places seems like a much more sensible idea.
Yeah, I think so. You know, and I think in general, you've got that spreading around. Well, like, I mean, this is a little bit different, but like Ukraine, for example, they have had to, because of obvious situations occurring, they are having to rapidly decentralize their grid to make it more resilient. Because when you have, you know, a single large transmission line or substations, they're very easy to target.
Very vulnerable.
Right. So splitting things up makes, you know, reduces the failure domains.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So yeah, it's very interesting time.
And I think this sort of move also makes Google a little bit more resilient to failures in the general grid by they're running their data centers off their own power source. But then if they've got an issue with the power source for whatever reason, then they can pull from the grid. So they've got a backup on their backup.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. That is that would be an option.
Hmm.
Or they have two SMRs at the same site.
Well, I'm assuming they're gonna have a lot of them. But yeah. The idea being that they have one there that produces the primary power, and the other one, or they're load sharing.
Yeah.
Between the two. And then
Well, you'd have to have some sort of redundancy because you've got to do maintenance on them, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so if I may, so you know the old adage about like every 9 of uptime you add into your things, it gets exponentially more expensive. Yeah. We've now hit the point where we're talking about having redundant nuclear reactors to power our data center. I think we might have gotten to the point where its cost is scaling up to infinite.
No one cares anymore.
I need 30 9s.
Yeah. A million 9s.
No, it needs to be perfect, 100%.
Yeah. I think if you get to a million 9s, you are basically there anyway, aren't you?
Yeah, I think so.
You get 1 second of downtime per 10 years.
I don't even think it would be that.
No, it's
not. Well, look, Australia's got a long way to go before nuclear power becomes a thing. So let's put that conversation on the shelf for now. Yes. But
we can gaze from afar, and
we can gaze in awe.
Live by proxy. That's right. But vicariously. Let's hope one day. Anyway, let's move on. Google Code Assist Enterprise. Google wants to simplify code for all. Now, you've played around with Gemini Code Assist. This is the enterprise version of it now, and you can feed in your whole repo, taking advantage of that Google's large context window. Google has unveiled Gemini Code Assist Enterprise, an extension of existing Gemini Code Assist platform aimed at tackling developer skills shortages. Interesting. It's made possible by the large context window, allowing developers to create more relevant code with assistance that considers the specifics of code bases and current development sessions. This is what we talked about when this first came out. You know, you're working on an enterprise code base. There's, style, code styles you've got to adhere to. There's particular functions and, routines that there could be thousands of them. You don't know them all from day one. Well, why not have Gemini Code Assist to help you do that and, fill in the blanks as you type things in.
And this sort of goes to the Code Assist stuff is sort of hand in hand with what we were covering in the last episode about the data agents, in that where Google are now ingesting your data into a separate side by side, like a sidecar model, that then they can query at the same time. So yeah, I use Code Assist when I'm coding sometimes, more than anything, to sort of give us some ideas. When I've got a mental blank, it's like, this is what I want to do, and go and write me some pseudocode for it, and then I'll flesh it out. But I think the thing that I suppose worries me about this is the price point that Google's aimed this at. Like, it's the tool is now generally available with prices starting at $45 per month per user. Which is well above what Copilot costs.
Yeah.
And look, it might be a better tool than Copilot. I don't know. I've never really used Copilot in anger. But I can't see an organization like, I think of the organization that I'm a member of, and we've got 30 odd developers that would be using this all day, every day. And $45 a user per month, that's a lot of coin.
Okay, so I would come back at it from the value perspective though, right? So now this is putting aside, like, not saying about how good the tool is or versus like Copilot or anything like that, but if you're in Google's ecosystem and you want a tool and the performance increase per employee is enough to cover it, like $45... I guess that's US. So, let's say about 70 a month ish.
Yeah, something like that.
Like, so 70 a month for a senior developer's time, like, that's not even an hour of their time. Right. So, if you get the equivalent of one extra hour of productivity out of an engineer in any given month, it pays for it. Like, that's your trade-off, right? Like, not having this at all. It's like, well,
I suppose I come back to with all of these tools that I've seen, when you use it to write code, you still have to make sure that code is correct.
Yeah.
Like, there's still a lot of manual work on it.
I'm not saying it's going to do all the job for you, no. but does it make you like you said it yourself, right? Like you use it if you're like, how do I kind of get started on this thing, right? Like how many times would you do that over a month? It only has, if it saves you an hour.
Well, it was a meme I saw the other day. Before AI, 1 hour to write, 2 hours to debug. After AI, 30 seconds to write, 6 hours to debug.
Yeah.
So.
No, well, and that's a bit true too, because you're not writing the code, so it's not, you're not thinking it through.
It's not baked into you.
Something else is thinking it through. And for a senior dev, like, okay, yep, we use a code assistant tooling at work. Most of our seniors don't use it because they're senior developers, and I would expect that senior developers don't use code assistant that much. I would expect that they are able to just come up with that code in their head because they're
sure. But where I'm sort of coming from, there'd be a lot of boilerplate that your senior engineer, right, like, is physically capable of creating, but this can help them with like knocking that part out quick. So it's like the boilerplate's done, so I can move on with actually doing value add. And
yeah, I suppose it, like, if you're setting up a new project, yep, all that boilerplate stuff should be pretty quick.
Anyway, it's there. I've no doubt people will use it even with the cost, but it's pretty cool that – I actually think it's pretty cool that you can do this stuff now anyway. All right, so moving on. Ian, tell us all about Parallel Store.
Cool. So Parallel Store is, for want of a better term, a distributed storage medium for AI and HPC workloads. So it's a distributed asynchronous object storage architecture. Parallel Store combines a fully distributed metadata and key value architecture to deliver high performance throughput and IOPS. So really, it's ideal for AI workloads and for HPC stuff, as the name suggests. But Google states here, for a 100 terabyte deployment, the maximum Parallel Store deployment currently available, throughput scales to about 115 gigabytes a second, and 3 million read IOPS, 1 million write IOPS.
Wow.
And a low latency of about 0.3 milliseconds. So there's some absolutely phenomenal numbers. For AI use cases, Parallel Store's performance with small files and metadata operations enables, they're claiming here, 3.9 times faster training times and up to 3.7 times higher training throughput compared to the native ML framework.
Awesome.
So really, really cool development. It is generally available now, so if you're using AI, your own AI model, or you're doing HPC stuff, jump on and have a look at Parallel Store and see if that fits your needs and your budget.
I mean, it sounds like, though, you know, if you can do it, you know, 3.9 times faster. So I'm sure it's not cheap, but if you're doing it in a quarter of the time, well,
yeah.
So you're tying up the GPUs for less time.
That's right.
So it may end up being cheaper in the long run.
Well, and don't forget now that you can have GPUs inside of Kubernetes. So what they've got here is a CSI driver for Kubernetes as well. So you can use Parallel Store in Kubernetes on your GPU instances to do like HPC or AI workloads in GKE. I think it's really cool little development.
So do you just access it like any other storage, like, you know, cloud storage or something?
Well, it's a an object storage. So it's sort of like cloud storage.
Right. Okay. It's an object store.
Yeah. But it's just like, it's like Google Cloud Storage on steroids.
Yeah. Souped up version. Yeah. Okay.
He's been lifting a bit.
This is your grandma's cloud storage.
All right, cool. Well, yeah, it'd be interesting to see when that actually gets implemented in some project. Who knows? If Microsoft had been using something like that, they might not have lost all these logs.
They might not have lost their logs. This is a bit of a sad note here, but this article from TechCrunch, where our dear friends at Microsoft have notified customers that they're missing more than 2 weeks of security logs for some of their cloud products, leaving network defenders without critical data for detecting possible intrusions.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so this was an incident that occurred, they're saying, was not a security problem, but just a misconfiguration that ended in a malfunction that dumped logs between September 2nd and September 19th.
Yeah, send them to DevNull.
Dump it. So maybe they run over their ingest quota and are like, oh, I don't want to pay for that.
That raises the sort of legalities of this.
If they've
deleted the logs, are they then responsible for the fines imposed on a company that has been compromised because they can't detect it in their logs?
Yeah, so that would be an interesting test case if somebody was breached within those days and then their own SIEM didn't pick up because it couldn't see the logs. Mm. That certainly could be an issue. And unfortunately, the systems that they lost logs for are important ones, like their Entra, which is so Microsoft Entra is the Active Directory system. You got Sentinel in there, Defender for Cloud, and Purview. Like, these are all things that you want the security logs for.
Yes, 100%.
So, affected customers may have experienced potential gaps in their security-related logs. So definitely not good. Not a nice thing to happen. They wouldn't answer specifics around what actually caused it, but just to confirm that it wasn't a breach that made them lose the data. Yeah.
An operational bug within our internal monitoring agent.
Yeah, and now they've rolled the change back, and then recording took place again. So, yeah, a bit of a stuff up there, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, if you're using Microsoft systems, then best be analysing any logs that you do get pretty closely.
Yeah. I'm sure that there was probably a load of engineers running going, oh, what's going on with our logging? And we must have an agent that's hung that stopped dumping logs out or something. I bet there was plenty of people who were digging in trying to find why they stuffed up with their logs.
Well, that makes me wonder, does a SIEM alert when it stops, it starts seeing a much lower log ingestion?
I mean, that would be something that you definitely could monitor.
Yeah.
They probably are now, I bet.
Well, yeah. Because it wouldn't have been something, if I was writing software for it, it wouldn't be something that I would think about is like, no, I just expect these logs to come through because they're provided from our cloud provider. I wouldn't expect that the cloud provider breaks their own logging system and all of a sudden all of my logs disappear. That wouldn't ever be a use case I would think of.
No, but now you'll need to, as well as planning for your redundant nuclear reactors.
Yeah, that's right.
But when you think about it, if you're going to make a sophisticated attack, one of the first things you might do is turn off the logging.
I mean, of course, or at least purge the logs afterwards.
Yeah, cover your tracks, right?
Yep. Yeah, wow.
All right, well, let's keep an eye on that because it's going to be really interesting to be a fly on the wall if there was a breach during
that time. Yeah.
Oh, boy. All right, well, let's get on talking about security, how to protect your site from DDoS attacks with the power of Google Cloud Networking and networking security. What's this all about, Ian?
So this is Google's Project Shield offering. So Project Shield is created by Google Cloud and Jigsaw, and powered by Google Cloud Armor, and it's a service that they provide to certain types of businesses, as a as a free unlimited protection against DDoS attacks. So it's available to news journalists, independent journalists, human rights organizations, election information and monitoring, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole heap of them. Go to the projectshield.google.com and you can read all about it. But essentially, it's not a new thing. Project Shield came out quite a few years ago, but it's they've written an article here about how it helps businesses to protect from DDoS attacks, because we do see a lot of DDoS attacks in the wild. And they have actually mitigated one of the largest DDoS attacks in the world to date, which was, let me just grab up the article here, as a DDoS attack reaching 398 million requests per second using the HTTP2 rapid reset. That was, it was 7.5 times larger than the previous DDoS attack that they used.
I think we discussed it on the show.
Yeah, we did on the old show, I think.
The old show, yeah.
On the old show, yeah. So it was a massive DDoS attack, and the throughput numbers are insane. So we're talking 3.47 terabits per second of throughput.
Phew.
That's, yeah, you sort of can't fathom that, really. Like, I know we can, because it's just a number, but it's, you think about how much traffic that is generating, it is phenomenal. So this is this article is all about how to stand up the firewall and Cloud Armor and everything to get yourself online. I know I'm using Cloud Armor at work to protect our endpoints. We're also using Cloudflare on top of that, so sort of double protected. But it is actually a really interesting tool, and it gives you the ability to switch on DDoS protection in the console. If you're under an attack, there's a big button in the top right corner of Cloud Armor. You click that button and it shuts everything down. Basically takes you offline for the time that the DDoS happens for, and then brings you back up. So there you go. That's nice. That's what Project Shield is, and how it's used.
Excellent. And if you use the Google Cloud module in Terraform, you'll find that there's some features in there that I created for this.
Yes.
So there's a flag in there. You can switch some of this stuff on and off, and you can have my code in your project, which would be nice.
Oh, that's nice.
Just watch for the bugs.
Just don't tell me about the bugs. That's it. very cool. All right, thanks, Ian. Let's move on. A bit of Android news. Aside from Windows trying to become Linux, Android's trying to become Linux. We've got a terminal in here now, do we, Dave?
Yeah. So this is pretty cool. I guess this is where we've seen over time as Chrome OS and Android continue to mature. So like Chrome OS has had for quite a few years now the ability to go to a developer mode and install like a Linux container, so which was really helpful for development. It looks like Android's getting one as well. And with recent updates, now with this this new terminal app that you'll be able to install, when you do it, it installs a little Debian VM. And from what I'm seeing in this this article from Android Authority, potentially you'll actually be able to have full GUI. So you can actually do like a whole GUI OS of Debian running on your Android box, which is, I think is pretty funky. And I think seeing, like, especially as Chrome OS and Android are kind of converging together.
Yeah. Merging.
Yeah. Seeing more and more of that, because I like Chrome OS. I like that very simple side of things. But sometimes you do need to be able to do something a little bit more power usery, and having those functions available is just perfect.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, very nice. I just had a quick search in the Play Store. It's not available there yet. A set of patches under Ferrochrome Dev Options was recently submitted to AOSP.
Yeah, so it's not made its way through yet.
No, it's not. It's in the open. Yeah. This new option. But yeah, okay. So it'll get to. It's a little green icon, or the green terminal icon. But you know, how are you going to use it though? Honestly,
use cases for that because once upon a time, I used to have an Android tablet. It was a Samsung Galaxy Tab back then, and I used to have a terminal on that. So there was terminal apps were prevalent, and I used that. I had our VPN installed on my tablet. I could just on the bus on the way home. It was like, oh, there's a fault on this web server or the backend server. Turn on the VPN, SSH into the box, and I jump in there and fix it whilst I was sitting on the bus.
Right.
So
with your tablet in your hand.
With my tablet in my hand. Yep.
Yeah. And so I guess that really gives you a way of, okay, there are SSH apps, there are VPN apps, there's like a lot of different ways that you could probably do that very specific thing. However, in like you might want to use a tool like Dig or, you know, just any other little, just a little Linux command. This would give you a way to be able to drop into that. And yeah, definitely. I think like in a tablet form factor, or you know, if this sort of ports more into sort of Chrome OS land as well, then being able to sit there on a laptop and nice and simple.
And I think Google's really aiming for the Pixel Tab to become the new desktop too. So there's capabilities there to plug that thing into screens and keyboards and all that, and just work as if it's your desktop machine. It's certainly powerful enough to do it.
Mm.
So I think you're right, this is that next step towards really replacing laptop machines with tablets.
They've been trying to do it for years, Ian.
Yep.
They've been trying to do it for years.
It will work for the majority of business users who don't need huge amounts of compute. And be able to multitask up the wazoo. Like a software developer, for instance, needs compute power to be able to do stuff.
Containers, if you
yeah, that's right, containers and all that sort of stuff. Whereas your average admin or a normal business user that's doing like stock control or something like that, they don't need a full blown laptop and all the rest of it. A tablet is perfectly acceptable. And there's some businesses out there that only use tablets, like property valuers, for instance. They do their property valuation on a tablet.
Just walk around with the tablet.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that this is perfect for them.
Mm. And they can just go back to the office and sit down and
plug into the dock at the office and away she goes.
Yeah. Away you go. Yep. All right, cool. Well, I'll just get it anyway when it comes out and chuck it on there and see what it's like. Be interesting.
Yep.
All right, so before we get on with the AI wars, what's our old mate Melon Husk up to? Elon Musk. I mean, he's pulled off a good one here. Elon Musk sets up 100,000 NVIDIA H200 GPUs in 19 days.
Yeah, him personally. He did it.
Well, there's a photo of him there with some fiber in his hand, patching some stuff in.
You should see that man's arms moving. 100,000 GPUs getting slotted in.
Jensen says the process normally takes 4 years, the first 3 years being planning. So the team at XAI reportedly went from concept phase to fully ready compatibility with NVIDIA's gear in less than 3 weeks. This includes running XAI's first AI training run on a newly built supercluster as well. What?
I question this a little bit because there is no way that NVIDIA could supply them 100,000 H200s in a 3 week turnaround.
There's no way.
There's planning and ordering that's gone in months before this.
Or you divert an order that was going to Tesla.
Yeah, well, you could have done that too. But you think about it and go, okay, there's 100,000 GPUs there. That's not a small installation by any means of anyone's imagination. You've got to have a serious number of engineers on the ground that know what they're doing and a serious number of network engineers that know what they're doing, because you've got to think 100,000 of those things are going to require a whole heap of network that you've also got to buy. So this wasn't a 19-day turnaround, as much as I'd like to believe it was. Mm-hmm. I think it was more like a probably 6-month turnaround with 19 days of actual implementation.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a fluff piece for both NVIDIA. Obviously, there's incentives on XAI to promote their own chops there. And also for NVIDIA to be like, look what they were able to do. You definitely should also buy 100,000 of these.
Yeah. You should. I mean, if you just take a look at that photo there, number one, Elon doesn't have a hard hat on. Everyone else has hard hats on. That's the first thing. Number two, have a go at the amount of fiber. And that's just one rack. There's going to be hundreds and hundreds of racks like this.
That's one node in the
one
rack.
One node in the rack. Yeah, yeah.
Wang says, going into detail.
You physically can't plug it in that time.
So Wang goes into detail describing the complex nature of the networking on that hardware. And he says that networking NVIDIA's gear isn't like networking traditional data centers. The number of wires that goes into one node, the back of a computer, is all wires.
Yeah.
Which is obviously fibers here.
You can see that there.
You can see that.
It's like every pin of the CPU, you know, has its own fiber connection. Yeah. Basically.
You can see the multi-tails coming down the left-hand side of that rack. It's crazy. It'd be 19 days of just plugging in wires.
Without any configuration, putting the racks in place or just running the cables themselves. Oh, man.
Yeah.
How? I don't know. Yeah, so I'm a bit skeptical as well, Ian.
Yep. Good news story, though.
Good news story. All right, let's do it. Let's get on with the favourite part of the show, the AI Wars. Look, we had a bunch of stuff for the AI Wars come through this week, but we had to cull a whole heap of it, and we've tried to bring you the best, juiciest stories that are out there.
We had articles that were slain in the AI Wars.
Slain in the AI Wars. And talking about supply and demand and NVIDIA getting their stock out, NVIDIA's Blackwell GPUs, that's their next generation, they're sold out for 12 months. Don't expect to get one for at least 12 months if you put your order in.
Because Elon Musk has bought them all. No. Of course. GPU, but you know.
Different, yeah. Microsoft. Earlier this week, Microsoft became the first cloud to deploy GB200 AI servers, with a company posting on X, formerly Twitter. How long do we need to keep saying that for? Yeah. But anyway, that's X, another conversation.
Twitter.
Microsoft Azure is the first cloud to run NVIDIA's Blackwell system. How's Elon getting 100,000 when they can't even produce the new ones in time?
I love the numbers here. So the custom built 2 reticle 4 NP TSMC process. There's a lot of acronyms there that no one really knows the meaning of.
I'm sure somebody knows.
Oh, I'm sure does. But the person who made it up, but he hasn't told anyone. The GPU die is connected with a 10 terabyte per second chip-to-chip link into a single unified GPU. Blackwell GPUs have 208 billion, with a B, transistors.
It's a good amount of transistors.
Yeah. That's just more billions are better, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Dave?
A wise man once said, more billions are better.
I knew this great dude who once said more billions is better.
The strike rate, 208 billion transistors.
Yeah.
How do you get all of those perfect?
You don't. That's why you have yields. And that's why how you can get like cut down GPUs. Same with like CPUs. That's why we have the whole stratification of CPUs, right? Is not every chip comes out perfect. The ones that do or are close enough to it are the ones that attract the largest premium price. And then they just basically, you know, their QA process helps hive off parts of the chip that don't quite meet the spec. And we end up with the cheaper chips.
Yeah. Cheaper version. Yeah.
But for me, it does make me wonder, like, when are we going to see a 5000 series like GPU? As in for consumer land, like there's just the money's not in it. They're getting so much money.
That's right.
Like, why would you want to dedicate any of the? Because it's all like TSMC is actually producing it all, right? Like, so you got to get try and get fab time to produce these cheaper parts. Like, why would they bother?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing that, and the reason why I was calling out the 208 billion transistors was because this is an increase of 80 on the 80 billion transistors that's in the Hopper series GPUs. So they've gone from 80 billion transistors to 208 billion.
Massive increase.
That's a huge. That's more than twice. So yeah, did the phenomenal numbers that are in it.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll see how they flesh out, eh?
Yeah, yeah. Let's see what. Well, Microsoft's got them. Let's see what models they train and what the next 12 months are going to bring.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Yeah. All right then, moving on, what else we got here? We've got AI can see clearly now. Google's AI improves environmental monitoring.
The song pops into my head.
This is cool because what we're able to do now is basically get a full image of the Earth without clouds.
Yeah.
We were able to do this before, but it wasn't very good. But now it's much better. Basically,
That's
done
it.
With AI.
Well, we're constantly taking photos of the Earth for various reasons. One of them is being we're monitoring the atmospheric conditions and the air quality of Earth. And clouds obviously move. So what this is essentially doing is taking, segmenting those photos and then. Stitching together all the pieces that don't have a cloud on it.
Cloud.
Identifying layering where the cloud the shadow is and then stitching together the bits that don't have it.
Yeah. Easy process to describe.
Yeah, really, difficult really to difficult implement. One to do.
Really difficult one to do, but AI can do it for us easily. Now, I never thought about this before, but when you think about it, the areas where the cloud most likely is are actually the important areas we do want to look at, the important areas we want to monitor, right? The really sensitive tropical rainforest ecosystems. They're the areas that produce a lot of that store and produce, store and soak up and a lot of the carbon dioxide and affect the atmosphere the most. And they're covered by cloud and we just can't see them most of the time. But now with this technology, we can.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this will have a lot more use cases than just the getting rid of clouds out of photos.
Yep.
Tracking troop movements on the ground.
Well, potentially.
Well, I'm thinking about planetary observation, trying to see the surface of Venus and stuff like that. You know, where's that going to take us?
Yeah, well, we send a probe around there and just keep taking photos of it for years and years and years like we have.
Until we actually get, some shots through the atmosphere. Wow. Yeah. You've already seen the impact that it's made with some of the satellite, the James Webb.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a perfect use case because you've got a huge data set and you're just looking for the changes, right?
Yeah.
Much easier to have a computer or an AI do that. Very cool. All right. More Google AI news. Globant unveils AI tool with Google Cloud for video search. Now, this is something that was always sort of touted as something you could do with Google AI, is that you could search videos, but we actually have an off-the-shelf tool now that uses it.
Yeah, well.
Now, having a little bit of experience in this space, I can tell you that the taxonification and classification of video is painful. So usually what will happen, it'll go into an ingest system and then you'll have a junior sit there and they'll add tags to it, like a news story or something like that. And they'll tag, 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 and it goes into the archive. Next one comes in, tag, 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 goes into the archive. And that's it. That's all the job is. And then later when they go to search for it, they've got all these tags and they can pull the stuff out, right? This software will do that automatically.
Okay.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, this tool is set to change how media companies, sports organizations, and enterprises manage video content. You know, have you ever wondered, like, you want to see that, you know, when Steve Waugh gets his 100 right before the right before lunch, you know, on New Year's Day, how they managed to pull that footage out so quickly, right? Well, you know, now that kind of thing gets tagged automatically. It allows instant search of clips, images, moments with large video libraries.
I was going to say, did you just say Steve Waugh getting his 100 before lunch?
It was Steve Waugh that got his 100 before lunch on New Year's Day?
Yeah. Yeah? But I'm like, I haven't heard that name in a few years.
No. Don't you remember? It's one of the defining moments in cricket. Yeah, come on.
I know. But I was like, hang on, Steve Waugh. Wow, that's it's been like 15 years since I've heard his name in cricket.
Yeah, it was 15 years ago. Oh, I could have said that. I could have said the Warnie to Mark Gatting ball. That was even earlier, right? That ball.
Yep.
All right. We're coming into cricket season.
Yeah, it is.
Watch out. Watch out.
We're already watching it, mate. We're already watching it.
So this is cool. Now, another thing it will do, for example, is upbeat ads can be avoided during emotional movie scenes. So that's the example that they give. But don't you hate it when TV cuts to an ad right in the important part of the show, and then it's like this crazy ad that just doesn't sort of go with the vibe of the rest of the
show? I mean, I remember 10 years ago watching free-to-air TV, but, it's not something that's embedded in my modern life.
Hey, nah. if Google has their way, then YouTube ads are going to get you, right?
So, don't get me.
I pay to not have them.
Yeah, that's good.
The minute they bring them in when I'm paying for them is the day I get rid of YouTube.
Yeah. You know it's coming. Anyway, we have a new video search tool that uses Google AI.
Dumped this whole segment.
Finally, the OAIC draws lines on data usage for generative AI training. Now, they've acted, I think, for a government organisation fairly quickly on this.
Yeah.
New guidelines issued by the Office of Australian Information Commissioner, the OAIC, clarify interpretations of existing Privacy Act legislation and how it applies to the use of personal and especially sensitive information when training or fine-tuning Gen AI models or systems. Now, this is particularly around PII and individuals' privacy.
Yes.
Not copyright materials or anything like that.
Yeah. But normally the Privacy Act only applies to companies with a turover of $3 million.
That's
but
right.
And the OAIC is saying this applies to any business that is using AI.
Yes.
Do you think this is very similar to like last week, last whatnot, we touched on the AI pact stuff for the EU? There's more of like the kind of Australian sort of local equivalent of where the regulatory frameworks will come in?
Well, this would form part of any sort of, you know, AI pact that we created here that would sort of feed into it, I'd imagine.
Yeah, right.
The guidelines also spell out that creating data sets through web scraping may constitute a covert and therefore unfair means of collection, which could also breach the Privacy Act stipulation that data to be collected by lawful and fair means. So you've got to be careful when you're web scraping. It says, where a third-party data set is being used, developers must consider information about the data source and compilation process for the data set. They may need to take additional steps, for example, deleting information to ensure that they are complying with their privacy obligations. Well, it's easy for us. We've got that DLP.
Yeah.
We can just run it through DLP, yeah. Australian lawmakers are following up on some of this AI stuff, but we'll see what else happens if the politicians actually come to a consensus on what needs to happen with some of it. But that's kind of a first move, I think.
Yeah, cool.
Okay, well, I think that's about it, guys. Look at that. Bang on 9 o'clock too. How's the timing?
Even with all our banter.
I was going to say, with all our rant at the start.
That's it. Well, it's been fun, guys. Thanks for joining me this fortnight. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music. Go to Apple Podcasts and write us a review. Go to YouTube, start the discussion there. And while you're there, smash that like button. It helps the show along. That's it. You can contact the show, contact@gcpbytes.com.au, or find us on the web, www.gcpbytes.com.au, and look out for the social media posts as well. This show has been sponsored by Hive Tech Solutions and Mantle Group. That's about it from us. Anything else from you guys?
No.
Have a great fortnight.
Yeah, I'm going to go put a jumper on because it's cold as here.
Oh, it's quite nice here.
I'm just about to
put
the air conditioner on because it's hotter than 10 hot things in here.
Yeah, thank you.
And I should get to my Commodore 64 this week, so I'll let you know how it goes.
Yep. Nice. Bated breath, mate. Bated breath.
All right. I'll catch you later. Bye.
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 But no, but I do understand. It's like, like the hue lighting and stuff that's like, it links to what's on the TV. So if there's like explosions, you get more like the light that comes out that way. It's like the ads as well. Like, big explosion on the screen. Have you got
everything's
got to
be integrated.
Well, that went very much downhill, didn't it?
Yeah. I'm just lowering the bar a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, there is that ad on telly at the moment. Well, yeah, there is that ad on telly at the moment. It's a talking TV. It's for a company. And a talking toilet.
Oh, okay.
And the toilet says, "I've seen some dumps in my time."
Oh, man, that's
but
a
nothing
bit
like your renovation.
You know.
Really shitty ads.
Yeah, you think you have a great job.
I had to. I couldn't help myself.